Welcome to The Book Show on Apollo Bay Radio. This is our second episode. My name's Lee Kelly, and joining me tonight is Megan Harrison, Deb Bradfield, Monique Gillam, Lynn Halloran, and Marion Backer. So we've got a cast of thousands. And following on from last week's episode, we'll have all the usual segments of What Are You Reading?, discussion about the Ilana Valenti four novels set in Naples, a view from the world of teenagers, and what's new in our local bookstore. So let's begin by asking, what are you reading at the moment, Deb?
Well, I'm actually reading those Ilana Valenti novels. I'm on the fourth one now, but that's been interspersed with Hershey Alley's Heretic as well. So, I'm a bit sort of schizophrenic with my reading at the moment.
We were talking about that last week, about whether you can maintain a couple of books at once. I can't. I've got to go straight through, but you obviously can.
Well, I'm not that good at it, actually, but it's just that it's the demands of the library. You know, I've got to get the books back. Someone else will want them, so that's why I'm doing that.
So what's that book about, The Heretic?
Oh, Heretic is, well, look, I'm reading it really to try and understand why Islam can capture people's minds so much that they will, you know, forfeit their lives and do jihad. So Hershey Alley is an ex-Muslim, and she's written a couple of books. But, that's really just trying to really understand the answers to those questions. They haven't been answered, unfortunately. But it's interesting to hear what she's got to say.
So was that a book that you had heard about from someone else, or you just were interested in the topic?
Well, it was actually because with the U3A we did last year, Ray did a course on political violence and terrorism, and a lot of it was about what was happening with Islamic State, etc. And that really fired my interest, and so I just wanted to find out really more about it because, you know, the fact that people that are non-Muslim convert and go off to do jihad, and it's not necessarily people who come from deprived backgrounds. You know, there are people that have had great educations and come from wealthy families and still, but this is able to capture their minds and convince them so much that they will do that. So I just find it fascinating why that is the case. And I don't think it's just sort of disaffected youth. It just it seems to be a variety of people. So, as I said, she hasn't got any answers, but she does pose some interesting questions. And she's talking about, it's why she feels that Islam needs a reformation now. So, it's been an interesting read. And I've only got about four or five pages to go. So I'm pretty much finished it. But, there are no answers.
Well, that's probably a great pity that she hasn't got any answers.
Yeah, it is.
That would have been helpful. Megan, what about you?
I've just completed, I think it's R.L. Palacio, Wonder. I'm ever on the quest to always find that new textbook that I can potentially teach with the young students. I always like to try and find a book they haven't read themselves, but I think this will actually have been quite popular.
Yeah.
But it was an interesting read. It's about a young boy who, at fifth grade, is going to school for the first time. He's been born with severe facial disfigurement, cleft palate, amongst the least of his problems. Had to have a piece of his bone from his hip put in to make a chin, really. But he's grown up constantly having people look at him and just have that kind of reaction. And he's, I think middle school, or is what they call it in the book, but, high school is tough enough anyway.
Yeah.
So he's ready to face it. And it's the people that he sort of befriends and befriend him. But it changes narrative, because I always love that in a book. So you see the older sister's viewpoint, how she feels sorry for him and how she always feels overprotective of him. and other children in his life. And so, yeah, but it's quite well written. It was quite good.
I remember that book from where I used to work last year. They did that very successfully. Librarians were very keen on it.
I think so many kids would read it that it may not be best to set it as a text. I always try to find them something that they're not going to pick up naturally. Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think the title refers to?
Oh, he was the wonder. It was actually a beautiful quote that he has this funny story told at his birth that his mother retells, and the nurse who is there through the entire process says something that, you know, he's a wonder because he was never expected to live beyond a few days, but any child has already overcometh the earth, which is quite nice. But yeah, so he was their wonder.
Great. Well, I've been continuing with the Hilary Mantel series, and I've not finished yet, but Bring Up the Bodies, which is the follow on it. This is when sort of Anne Boleyn comes a bit undone. So again, it's the focus on the Tudors and the sort of workings of their government, told from the point of view of Thomas Cromwell. But I was thinking as I was reading it, it is a great effort to write an historical novel because you have to be so sure of the context you're writing about. You have to understand what was going on. You have to have the dates. And then you have to sort of try and mesh that into characters that their actions have already been committed. You have to try and imagine what their motivations were. Mm. And I think he does a great job. She does a great job with Anne Boleyn as someone who became so focused on who was plotting against her and, you know, who was thinking this and that. She becomes quite paranoid. So it sort of helps explain how they turned against her when she was the one that Henry had sought and had gone to so much effort to make his wife, you know, that she became so controlling. And I like that when you start to think about an historical figure differently as a result of reading something.
I always want to know what they've based it on. Like, was she actually much of a writer herself? Did she have diaries and things?
Yeah,
and,
no.
Or is it just purely, yeah,
fiction? I do remember as a child seeing the film Anne of a Thousand Days, I think it was, and it was that French actress, and she was so beautiful, and she used to, you know, be dressed so beautifully. And when she goes off to get her head chopped off, you see her little daughter Elizabeth with the red hair coming behind her, and it was just horror because you know what happens. The poor little girl. But I've got another view of Anne Boleyn now. Compliments of Hilary.
Yeah, so which is the real one?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. She's just interpreting it. But then all history's like that, isn't it, really? It's just an interpretation. We weren't there. We never really know what people's motivations were.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So that's a good range of books to read. We're going to discuss now the Alana Valenti series about friendship between two women in post-World War II Naples, Italy. I'm going to call the two main characters Lanu and Lila, but they get called a lot of different things in the book, so it could be like last week's Werner and Werner. But that's just the way it is when you read, isn't it? You get it stuck in your mind, they're called this, and you stick with it. There are four novels in this series, and they span about 60 years of the lives of these two women. The first one is called My Brilliant Friend, the second one, The Story of a New Name. Then it's followed with Those Who Leave and Those Who Stay. And the final book is The Story of the Lost Child. In total, there's 1,700 pages. So this series is not for the faint-hearted. It's been an incredible publishing phenomena. They have sold millions of copies and been translated into all sorts of languages. It's been on lots of bestseller lists. The books deal with issues like friendship, identity, family, marriage, the role of women, and particularly that tension between motherhood and the career, post-war Italian society, the changing nature of technology and how that impacts on lives, and a lot more. The really interesting thing about these is nobody actually knows who Alana Valenti is. It's a pseudonym that she uses. And recently, I think she was, they were discussing the book at the Sydney Writers' Festival, and her translator stood in place for Alana Valenti. Mm. It's assumed that she was, that the story is partly autobiographical, that she grew up in Naples and that she's probably been married and had children, etc. But no one actually knows. And she has done a few interviews and talked about why that is, why she's maintained this pseudonym. She's done these via email. And I thought that was a really interesting idea. She sort of said that the story should speak for itself. It doesn't need me to speak for it. Once I've written the book, it's out there and it's in the public domain, and it can live or die on its own merits. And I think that's interesting. She sort of refuses to engage with the celebrity of the writer. Mm. Anyway, we'll start talking about the first one, My Brilliant Friend. And it begins with a conversation between the character of Lanou and Reno, who's Lila's son, where Lila has disappeared. And this comes as no shock to Lanou, because she reveals that Lila had always said she would do that one day. She would just disappear and you would not find any trace of her. And Lanou is mad that this has happened. And so the sort of premise the book begins with is that she's going to write down the story of their lives, these 60 years of their lives together, because she's not going to let her erase it, you know. She's going to tell her version of the story. So the first novel deals with this early stage of their life from about the time they were six until I think they're 16 at the end of the first one. So, Deb, did you enjoy My Brilliant Friend?
Yes, I did. Well, I'm on the fourth book, so I must have enjoyed it because I kept going. Although I did... In the second book, I did get a bit, oh, I don't know whether I'm going to continue with this, because it started to me to get a little bit soap opera-ish.
Yeah.
And we just seemed to be going back and forth between the two, and it was like, oh, here we go again.
Yeah.
But then she seems to have some way of just getting her talons into you, and then she'll write something that you think, oh yes, that was so insightful, that you then she's got you back and you keep going. So yeah, I did. I enjoyed the first one very much. I enjoyed that sort of portrayal of Naples, post-war Naples. I thought was fantastic. I've been to Naples, and it's very much, even today, I think it's very much as it was portrayed in the book.
The stereotype when you're doing the backpacking tour was, you know, you had to keep your money belt nice and close to you when you're in Naples.
Yeah, I think you still do, actually. What shocked me about Naples when I was there was the kilometres and kilometres outside Naples of shanty towns where I think, refugees were living. It was really extreme. And there are still places there where, like, you'll see a half a building that must have fallen down in an earthquake, and like trees are growing up through it, but it's just sitting there. So it's a fascinating city, and you get the feel of it from the book. Also the sort of It's a feminist book in a way too, really, because it's just, you know, that none of the men in the book come off very well at all. Although, having said that, I suppose that also
Enzo,
the women.
Enzo's
the only one. He comes in. Well, he actually arrives in about the third book. Well, he might have been.
Yeah, he's
in
there
it.
In the childhood stage, but then he disappears.
Yes, actually, I found what she does is that at the front of all of the books, she has all of the characters and what family they're in. So if you want to, you can go back and check. But look, I haven't really bothered doing that much because I'm actually not that interested in them. It's like you've just got these sort of people in the background that are all these school friends and friends from the neighbourhood. But we've really only got those two central figures, and they're really the only ones you're interested in. Other people waft in and out a bit, but I'm just not that interested in them, so I really don't even bother to find out whose sister they are or who their mother was.
It's interesting you're saying that about Naples, because a real background to the book is that constant struggle to get out of the poverty and ignorance into which the girls were born, and really they take two separate paths through that. And so that the context is really important because, you know, that is the classic story of escaping poverty, how you choose education.
Actually, one of the things I'd like to say about that is the language, because that's one of the things that a theme that runs through it too are these two languages. There's the dialect, which the people that never get out of the neighbourhood speak in, and then there's the others with an education who actually speak Italian. So the dialect being, you know, quite dissimilar, it seems, to Italian. So that's a theme that runs through constantly too, and you sort of come back to that every now and again about the dialect, and when people get angry, they're going into dialect. And
I imagine that was completely lost with the translation as well. I imagine reading that in her original it would have had a very clear, distinct difference.
That's, yeah,
with
that's
the voice
a really good
of
point.
The characters, and we just don't get that at all.
No, no.
And I'm interested, like, I've only read the first book, but do the rest in the series stand alone? There is no cliffhanger at the end. It does
there
have
is.
That fantastic premise at the start, which I think is almost like revenge, because she's quite petty. She says she hasn't spoken to her for years when she suddenly gets this call from the son.
But I think that's that. For me, that's at the heart of this series, that sort of she is petty, and at times she really dislikes Lila. And they fight, and there's tension and rivalry and jealousy between them. And whilst that might seem a bit extreme if you're thinking about your own friends, it's still, it is a part of relationships, isn't it? That, you know, you can have the strong, close relationship with someone and still feel a bit jealous of the achievements that they've had, or, you know, the way that they perceive you, or they put you down, and that tension stays there.
Yes, I was actually thinking that very thing when I was reading it. I was wondering, can you actually have a friendship that has no jealousy at all? I mean, this might be saying something about me. You get a friend because you admire, you know, well, you have friends because you admire or you like something about them.
Yep.
And then maybe there's always a little bit of jealousy there. So I thought that was actually very believable, because I think friendships and relationships are like that. They're a mixture of love, hate, jealousy, you know, all of it.
Yeah, and that really is the basis of good literature, isn't it, where it makes you reflect on your own experiences. I had a school friend who was good at sport, and she was always good-looking.
I had one of those.
I don't have any friends from that period in my life, like that young, really. But I felt very sort of even aware of it, probably around the age of the end of the first book, when I was 16. I had nothing in common with any of the people I was surrounded by except a history. I had no common interests to actually maintain a friendship beyond high school. And so, yeah, the majority of my friendships really are from people I've met who did have that similar interest and shared a yearning for the same kind of knowledge from uni and things, that, yeah, rather than anyone from. But this girl shared her entire life from a very insular, small neighbourhood where everyone knew everyone's business. I don't know if they fully escaped it, if that rivalry is still so strong in their lives, even though they haven't spoken for so long.
Yeah, but I think the whole four series, we're jumping ahead here, but that's okay. the whole four series deals with that idea of the impact our initial environment has on us, you know, whether you can ever actually leave that. Because I think a lot of people would resonate with that idea of, you know, you leave your neighbourhood because you don't feel it's got anything for you anymore. You've outgrown it, or you want to try something new. But those things stay with you in subtle ways that you mightn't even realise. I mean, certainly not subtle in this book. They are that background of having grown up in those sort of poor streets of Naples is defining for both women. But, you know, just the idea that it, that you were saying, that, you know, you feel at certain stages you want to reject your past. But I think Verante's talking about that, really. Can we do that, you know?
Yeah, but do the women create themselves in a way as well? Like you were saying before, they choose different paths to get out of the poverty. And I was saying, I read the entire thing thinking that the other friend was the brilliant one who was naturally gifted and yet never had the opportunities. Yet the narrator is the one who's called the brilliant friend. I suppose she's nicer, which makes her the better friend, but she's just not the naturally brilliant one of the two. But I'm assuming they recreate themselves. Like, we watch her before her wedding, completely change the way she appears in the neighbourhood, what she wears.
Yes, true.
Yeah, does that progress in the later books as well? They recreate complete new lives for themselves. Are they still the same girls, or do they change or try to change who they are?
I think that they do keep changing, but they also remain the same.
Yeah.
So,
and they lock on to those ideas of, I think they both in some way see each other as the brilliant friend, you know, because Lila, like you said at the start, she is the one that seems to be clever without trying, always has the answer. And she describes her as always very firm, knows what to do. And Lanou feels, you know, in awe of that. And then when she finds out that Lila is actually in awe of her and the way that she's become a successful publisher and, you know, novelist, and she's shocked because she doesn't feel that. She always feels like she's the lesser party. Mm-hmm. So there's sort of tension like that between them their whole lives. But did you find that believable as a friendship?
I didn't see the attraction so much. I understood the rivalry. I understood how close they were being where they're from. But I didn't find it believable that they'd be, that actually like each other necessarily. Or not something that went beyond childhood, I suppose. I saw no need at the end of the first book for them to remain true friends for a very long time. It seemed a very decisive point where they actually would separate rather than remain together. She goes off marrying and it's quite clear she's on a very different path. And the other, she's such a dedicated student. She's up at 5 a.m. every day studying.
Perhaps you should recommend this to your students in school as a role model.
But she actually doesn't even know where that's going to take her either, though. I loved the idea when they sort of suggested she go to high school. She didn't know it existed. Yeah. Like, what's a high school? No. So it's not like she had a clear path. She was just constantly pushing herself wherever she was placed. But yeah.
But I think that thing about them, so being best friends, I don't know whether I'd call them best friends. It's almost like they were sort of intertwined in a way that they could not extricate.
Like
they couldn't extricate themselves.
Yeah. 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 And their identity is bound up with one another.
In fact, were they two of one person? I mean, were they halves of one whole? As you pointed out, the difficulty of trying to juggle a career and have a family, and also, well, because of the period in which it was set, it's also women struggling to get out from under the thumb of the men who. Yeah. You know, like really, when we start off in the 60s in Naples, a woman is not allowed really to do anything. They just have to stay at home, look after the kids, make dinner for their husbands, and any straying from that really is frowned upon. So,
and really, that's what's picked up in that second book, because Lila signs on for that, but she can't really stay with it. Her personality is such that she becomes driven, and she's trying to achieve things, and she can't play that submissive role, which brings her a lot of trouble with.
Yes, I doubt if she ever thought she really could. I don't really know why she married. I think it was, again, that sort of what a woman's supposed to do in that period. There was a lot of pressure from her family because he was a very good match, you know, a very good catch, I should say. A lot of pressure there, and she probably was sort of forced into doing it. But she's a bit of an enigma. Mm. You don't really, you know, you sort of wonder why is she doing this and why, she's...
Well, some of it's certainly, I reckon, about her quest for power over her life, which is the sort of feminist theme coming up. She... You know, one of the Solaris brothers was after her and she hated him.
Yes, well, they were like the local mafia, Solaris brothers.
Yeah. Well, there's certainly really strong parallels with Naples society at that time with them. But she wanted her to make him suffer. Like, she, part of her motivation, I think, for marrying was that he wasn't going to have her.
Yes, it's actually a wonder that any of us like her at all, really, because, you know, she can be so vicious, even to, you know, this, to, I call her Eleanor, so I'm struggling now with Lanou. their relationship. So, yeah, she can be really very vicious. In fact, most of the time she's vicious.
But that was, I thought I liked that bit that you know, that idea of having a friend who absolutely tells it to you like it is.
Yes,
you know?
I wish I could do that, actually. I'd like to have the courage to do that.
Like she's a successful writer, and she gives her things to read, and she'll tell her that it's crap, you know. And I know it was. But it's, you know, it's like her own conscience coming back to her.
Yes.
But that issue about women's choices, I think, is strong in the book. You know, like.
Yes, if they have any choices.
Yeah. Lanoue takes that path. She tries to make herself a career as a writer, but yet she still feels the need to marry. And in her relationship with Nino, particularly, you see again that powerlessness of women.
Mm.
You know, he's a womanizer and she gets caught up in that, and yet she's the one that's been the successful.
Yes. Yes. Well, actually, speaking of Nino, when. Just before Megan left, she said about the cliffhanger, and it was that cliffhanger at the end of the third book, which I thought was a bit cynical, actually. We won't say what it is, but I thought, oh, this is a real hooker. Now I have to read the fourth one because of that.
Yeah. I thought the character of Nino was really interesting because he becomes part of the rivalry between the two women. Because he's the one that Lanoue always fancied, and that yet Lila seems to pick him up, you know, with no effort at all. And
yes,
it's sort
as
of,
she does with everything. Yeah. Everything is sort of effortless for her.
Yeah.
She can just do everything, and everyone really sort of is in awe of her or frightened of her. Yeah.
But I guess that's also too. We are seeing it through Lanoue's perspective. She's the narrator constantly, that's how she. She views it, you know. It's not how it would have been interesting if we'd had a chance to hear from Lila a bit more in her own views on these things.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't actually thought about that. Yeah, maybe we could have another four books written from Lila's perspective.
Same story told from a different perspective. I thought the character, you know, you have to ask yourself the question about why have these books been so phenomenally successful?
Well, I have asked myself that. Haven't
I? It's going to be like The Heretic. You haven't got an answer.
No. Well, actually, I googled this afternoon to see if I could find out any negative reviews. Mm. I couldn't find a single one, and I thought, well, there must be something wrong with this book. You know, I mean, a lot of people are talking about it being this sort of literary masterpiece, and I'm not so sure about that, really. But that seems to – that's a thread that's running through a lot of the reviews. And as I say, I couldn't find anything sort of negative about it at all.
Well, it is a complete world, you know, as shown by all the names at the front.
Yes.
You can see how they're all connected. It is a complete world and quite engrossing when you get involved in it. But I do think there are times – my criticism of it would be that it feels like, especially early on, there's just, you know, they go out and then they're confronted by something, and then there's angst afterwards, and then they go out and they're confronted. And it felt like it was bobbing up and down on the spot a bit.
Yes,
I think when the girls get older.
Mm, and that they happened have to me in the second book.
Yeah, for sure. I thought what might appeal is that, you know, like we said at the start, there's so many ideas you could pick up, but I think Nino and the idea of the man that you fall in love with, that's the, I hope my husband's not listening to this, that turns out to be a cad, you know, and it takes her so long to realise that. But I think that's a disillusionment of all women, isn't it, when you're young and you see a musician or something and you think they're absolutely perfect, and then you read something about it and you think, oh, dear,
yeah, don't
what
we
was
all
I thinking?
We all love the naughty boy. We just can't resist them.
So I think that's interesting. And the other idea that we've got the sort of feminist stuff, and we've got this idea of, you know, the friendship, but I think also the idea of the importance of your place and coming to terms with your family and your background and how your life first began, you know, is something that is also quite interesting.
Yeah, it is. The other thing also that we haven't talked about much was the political climate.
Oh, yes.
In Naples and sort of during the late 60s, where, you know, people were really starting to, you know, say, well, hang on a minute, we're not going to put up with this anymore. We're working in these factories for, you know, no money at all, terrible conditions. And so that thread ran through, was that book three?
Yeah, it's sort of there throughout, really, because even Lanou at one stage becomes an advocate for the workers, you know, and Lila, that's her sort of fixation.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's certainly that idea and the disillusionment that happened to the boys that, you know, are the communists in that period and then, you know, get arrested and imprisoned and tortured and things like that. It's sort of that whole passing out of, you know, the idealism of your youth.
Yeah.
You know, into a reality that's much meaner and...
Yes. So I guess this is why we do like, because there's really so much in it, isn't there? There's just so many threads to it and so many sort of different angles.
Yeah. So we'd recommend it?
Oh, well, definitely, yes, for sure. But to come back to your first question, I don't know that I'd recommend it to too many men. I'm just not sure. I think, well, Brian, I believe, has read book one and he's ready to go with two, three and four if he could ever get them back from all the women that have borrowed them. But but then he's a special sort of man, so I don't know about, you know, men in general, maybe they should give it a try and see what they think.
So perhaps we'll put that caveat on it that, you know, maybe not so much for men. It's more of a female text and you have to persevere through two because three and four are better.
Yeah, I think it was only the beginning of two, actually, up until about halfway through two and then it sort of got me again. Mm. But that was interesting that it did just sort of get, I thought, oh, no, this is just turning into a soap opera.
Yeah.
So, yeah, interesting.
Thanks. So Alana Valenti's four-book series, they call the Neapolitan series, and you'll find them in libraries everywhere, I'd imagine. You're listening to The Book Show on Apollo Bay FM, and we've had a bit of a change of panel here. I've got Lynn Halloran now, who is from Galapagos Books, so we'll ask you what we always ask, Lynn, after our 2 weeks of this show. So it's a liberal use of always. What have you been reading?
Well, good afternoon. At the moment I'm reading a rather strange kind of book. It's called Miss Peregrine's Peculiar Children. It's written by a chap called Ransom Riggs, which sounds very kind of, you know, theatrical, but I did look him up. And, he's only a youngish author. It's kind of intriguing because he actually takes old photographs. That's what this particular author likes to do. He likes to collect photographs, very old ones from garage sales, etc. And he's actually written three novels based around these rather obscure and quite old pictures, which he sort of incorporates within the story. Very strange, very entertaining, and of course it's about to be brought out into a movie in September.
Which is what happens to all good
which
books.
Which happens to all of them. Just rather intriguing and something very different.
Do the pictures, are they each separate books or is there three pictures in the one book?
No, he uses quite a few pictures per book, like there could be 20 or more pictures, not related at all.
Oh, okay.
As in, like, they're not related to each other. Just the stories that he weaves, he sort of weaves those pictures into that story.
Okay.
Sounds really unusual.
Does it read like short stories or does it read like
one continuing? No, it's a continuing story. It's about peculiar children, which means they have different talents.
Oh, okay.
Very different talents. We would consider them quite odd in our world. And they don't live in our world. They live in an alternative realm, I suppose.
Oh.
And it's just the interaction. And, of course, something happens. And then they have to sort of band together and work with it. So, but it's just the whole concept of using these very somewhat old photographs and weaving a story around all of them. Quite entertaining.
You, of course, have access to all the latest and greatest because you've got a whole bookstore to choose
I do.
From.
It's very difficult to choose.
Yeah. That's what I really was going to ask you. How do you guide your reading? Do you find that you're reading mainly contemporary things that have just been published or do you, because you have access to the back catalogues, you know, catch up on all those things?
It's really quite entertaining to sort of choose because I'm very fortunate that I get pre-published, which is always lovely because then I can actually read them and therefore I have some knowledge of it if I want to talk about them. But that gets really frustrating because people come in and say, oh, do I recommend any books? And I go, I do, but it's not published yet.
Oh, so okay.
That becomes a bit of a problem. And I also have my own choices that I like to read. And then, of course, yeah, there are some classic ones that you just think, I've really got to read that. You know, it might be years old, but you've just got to read it.
It's a terribly difficult thing to recommend books for people because it really does. It's such a personal thing, you know, what people will enjoy. And
It's kind of the question I hate the most. Mm. And it's not a reflection on the people who ask, but they say, would you like to recommend something? And you go, you know, you have to know what they like. Mm. And it's a really subjective thing. But
well, having said that, we'll now ask you to discuss some things that you would recommend.
We were talking a little bit in the break there about the differences with generations and parents and children, and it reminded me of one that I read probably about 12 months ago, but it's very relevant. And internets and things, which we've all heard of a lot, but there was one which is called Cry Blue Murder, unusual title in that it is actually about internet discussions. And it follows two girls who are sort of get to know each other over the internet, just messages back and forth. One's from Melbourne, one's from Mildura, which I thought really brought it home to a local content. And it's about some murders that have occurred, and these girls just discuss it. And, you know, because they're only teenage girls, and they discuss it. And it just, without giving too much away, it just kind of shows how easily we can be misled.
Mm.
And it's, you know, quite dangerous for children to...
Books like to believe that.
Everything that they kind of, you know, what I say I am and what I am are two different things.
Books like that tread a fine line, though, don't they? Because this is what we're talking about with Monique last week when she said about a book that she'd read that told the perspective of a male and then the same story from the perspective of a female. It's a really interesting idea, but teenagers particularly are very loath to be preached to about things. You know, they're like, do you think that book...
Definitely. It doesn't really, because you're actually, it's almost you're sitting in present time with them. It's a little bit unusual in that it probably needs to be a little bit older reader. It would have to be at least early teenage, because it actually has the criminal, the police reports and everything that these murders that are going on. So you've sort of got that interspersed with the discussions between the two girls, and it actually doesn't preach. It doesn't give any opinion on the fact they're talking. You're just privy to the conversations they are having. And you're kind of taken into the same thing that the girls are taken into, because you believe what they're saying. And, of course, it doesn't always turn out that way.
Mm.
So it doesn't preach. It just shows the danger very, very accurately without preaching.
Mm. That sounds interesting. Any others you want to... We're going to run out of time.
Very quickly, for a slightly older audience, I really liked one called Disclaimer. It's an easy read. It's not a complex read, but it's about people's perception. And I like books that kind of allow you to do that. And this particular one, very quick, Precy, it's like a lady who's just moved house, sort of thinks they want to read something. A novel appears sort of on her bookshelf. She goes, oh, I'll read this. And then she realises the book's about her earlier in her life.
Mm.
And it progresses what the impact of finding that book has on her husband, her child and everything else. And it's just really, really good to read. And I can't say a lot more, because it's got a really good ending. And it's all about people's perception.
Mm.
Excellent.
There'll certainly be some things that she might have to answer to.
Yeah, maybe.
So... in Galapagos Books, do you find are there anything that is really popular at the moment, or anything people are really seeking?
Look, it's really varied because we obviously have a fairly big tourist base as well as the locals. You sell some interesting things to interesting people. Like, I've sold some quite political things to some Asians, and I'm thinking, why would they be really intrigued with Australian politics? But, you know, that's fine. Very, very varied. The popular books that are promoted, we obviously sell quite a few of. But, yeah, it's pretty varied across the thing. And I sort of try to have a bit of everything rather than, you know, being too specific, because, it's difficult to appeal to everyone, but we try.
I think you'll be very valuable additionally when we try and discuss genres, because you're probably across it more than your average reader.
You may be across a lot, not very deep, I don't know.
Okay. Well, thanks for those views. And we're just about out of time here. So next week, we thought we might discuss, well, it's likely we will discuss Sebastian Falk's book, Where My Heart Used to Beat, which I haven't read yet, but I'm hoping to. And I understand a story about a man with experiences of war that he revisits later in life, including a romance that had quite a significant impact on him. So if anyone's out there wanting something to read, and then you can listen to us ramble on about it next week. So Sebastian Falk, Where My Heart Used to Beat. Okay, so I think that's all from us this week. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll be back next Tuesday at 5 o'clock.
If the dull substance of my flesh were thawed, injurious distance should not stop my way. For then, despite of space, I would be brought from limits far remote where thou dost stay. No matter then, although my foot did stand upon the furthest earth removed from thee, for nimble thought can jump off sea and land as soon as think the place where he would be. But thought kills me that I am not thought, to leap large lengths of miles when thou art gone. But that's so much of earth and water road, I muster 10 times leisure with my moan. Receiving naught by elements or slow, but heavy tears, badges of either's woe. The other two slight air and purging fire, both with thee wherever I abide. The first my thought, the other my desire. These present absent with swift motion slide. But when these quicker elements are gone, in tender embassy of love to thee, my life be made of four with two alone, sinks down to death oppressed with melancholy, until life's composition be recured by those swift messengers returned from thee, who even now come back again assured of thy fair health, recounting it to me. This told our joy, but then no longer glad, I send them back again, and straight grow sad.